Okay, so get this in the right sequence. Okay, so the plan is to continue the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the great discourse on the Buddha's passing away. And it's a long discourse. We started this, I can't remember when it was now, maybe 2 months ago or something. Yeah. That doesn't matter because it's kind of a composite sutta with many different elements. And it doesn't matter so much if you do it piecemeal or whether you do it all in one go. It's impossible to do it all in one go anyway. Yeah. So it's more important to get the overall gist of it over a long period of time. I think that's perfectly okay. Yeah. And so there are some very nice things about this particular sutta that I mentioned last time. One of the things is that because it is the Buddha's final days, he is aware that this is his last chance to kind of summarize his teachings, to let people know what his teachings are really about, what is the essence, what is the core of these teachings. Right? So what you can expect to find in the suttas is a kind of summary. What does the Buddha see as a summary, the essence of all the things that he taught over a period of 45 years? That can sometimes be useful, right? Because sometimes you wonder, there's all these books, which am I supposed to read? And that's what the Buddha tells you, what you're supposed to read, basically. That's part of the deal here. So that is one side of it. Another side of it, because the Buddha knows that he's going to pass away, he knows that he has to lay down some ground rules to the Sangha, to the Buddhist community. What do we do? How do you practice from now on? How do you cope, when I'm gone, basically? When you don't have somebody like a father you can go to and say, we have a problem. What is the right thing? Okay, this is the rule. Bang, and put down the rule. There's no kind of final person of authority anymore. How do we carry on the Sangha? What is the basis on which we decide if there are disputes and all of these kind of things? And so for this reason also, it is very interesting because it guides us even in the present day how we're supposed to practice and live Buddhism. Because the Buddha lays down how to do things in the future of the Buddhist community. And we have already seen this already to some extent. Last time we had a look at the things that they call the seven factors of non-decline, or the things that you do to to be growth in the Buddhist community and growth in the Buddhist Sangha. And so that we have already had a look at that already. So that was things like, frequently meeting in harmony, living in the forest, making sure the arahants are looked properly after, and all that, those kind of things. And then from there on, after this, the Buddha now talks about other sets of seven qualities that need to be looked after for there to be growth in Buddhism, growth in the teachings. And it's interesting that there is just a large number of sets of seven, one after the other. Those sets of seven, they vary a little bit depending on which tradition you read the sutta in. This sutta exists also in Chinese, which comes from a different school of Buddhism, comes from the Sarvastivadin school. And the number of sets that are there is actually slightly different from the one in the Pali. There's actually more sets in the Sarvastivadin version than there is in the Pali version. And this kind of alerts you to the fact that here there's quite likely to have been some additions. Once you have one set of set qualities, it's easy to put in another set of seven qualities because it kind of fits the context. And anyway, we're just summarizing the teaching of the Buddha, right? So that's what they would have thought in those days. So let's just add in a few more sets there to kind of make sense. So it's hard to know exactly how many of these were actually told by the Buddha at this particular time. And I think that this most likely is the one we had a look at last time, which is the most likely to be authentic because it is a different set of seven from what you find elsewhere in the suttas. It is unique to this occasion, to the Buddha's passing away. It fits the context with the Buddha laying down the ground rules for how to look after the Sangha, look after Buddhism in the future when he is gone. Whereas these other sets of seven, they're kind of standard sets that you find throughout the suttas. They are still real, it's still real Buddhism, there's nothing wrong with them. It's just that they And for that reason, I will go through them a little bit faster than the other set of seven, but I will go through them because there's a lot of interesting little points in these sets of seven as we have a look at this. And at the very end, there is a set of six qualities as well, which I will also have a look at in perhaps a little bit more detail. Okay, so now we have reached the paragraph which is numbered 1.7 in Morris Walsh's translation of this Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and we will take it from there, see what happens. So this is the Buddha staying at the vulture's peak. I will tell you another seven things or quality conducive to welfare. Where are we? Conducive to welfare. Not sure where that happened, where I came from. Now, lost it. Okay, anyway, so conducive to welfare for the Sangha, etc. And when prosperity and decline, there will be no decline in the Sangha, the Sasana, or for the monks literally here, but the whole Buddhism is kind of included there. As long as the monks do not rejoice, delight, and become absorbed in works, it says here. And then in chattering, sleeping, company, evil desires, mixing and associating with evil friends, as long as they not rest content with partial achievements, as long as monks hold to these seven qualities and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So here we have a standard set of sevens that you find elsewhere in the suttas. The first one here is about not rejoicing, delighting, and becoming absorbed in works, it says here. The Pali word for works here is kamma, and in this case it means like action, right? Basically work, or I think maybe one of the best translations in this context is actually activity. You don't become absorbed or delighting in too much activity, because activity can take so many different types. They can be good activities, bad activities, but generally the idea of being absorbed in these things is what is problematic. So as it says here, actually, the problem is not actually so much the being absorbed, which is a translation that is used here, but it's more the fact that you delight in these things. Because when you delight in these things, then of course that tends to become the main focus in your life. Instead of delighting in Dhamma practice, in meditation, whatever it is, you delight in these external things that are not directly related to the Dhamma practice, and sometimes even take you away from these things. But this doesn't matter, this doesn't mean that we should, that, you know, monastics shouldn't do any work. That's not really what it means. What it means, rather, is that your attitude to that work is right. Your attitude is one where you understand that this has a particular place on the path. You're doing your service to the community, you're doing your part in keeping the Buddhist teachings going. So you do it, but this does not become the main focus of your practice, where all you're doing is work. So work is okay, but work with the right attitude, right? So when you put it aside, you don't kind of miss the work and you'd rather go back to it or whatever, but you use that work as a support for your meditation practice, rather than work itself becomes a mainstay. This is important because it's so easy to get sidetracked with things in the world. So it's easy to get sidetracked by things like work. Because for one reason is that we tend to be very restless. Our minds always wants to do things. And one of the reasons for that is because we identify with the doer. We identify with doing things. So many people in our world, they see themselves as I'm the agent in my life, right? I do stuff. And because I'm the agent in my life, identify with that, it feels almost like you are, if you don't do things, you feel almost like your sense of identity is threatened because you don't actually do things. So through work, people tend to express their identity, right? You express who you are, and that's why it can be difficult just to sit down and not do anything at all. it is almost as if your identity is threatened in a certain sense. So that is one of the reasons why this is important. You want to go beyond that kind of identity, because that kind of identity obviously has its limitations, and it stops you on the path of meditation if you identify too much with that. So that is one part of it. Another part, I think, of being engaged in a lot of work and activity, often it has to do with the fact that life isn't always all that wonderful and great, right? Sometimes life is kind of, if you just haven't got too much to do and you kind of just sit around, you meditate, maybe your meditation isn't going all that well. Often we use things like work to kind of suppress a feeling of dissatisfaction or even a slight sense of suffering in our lives, right? Once you stop, then this underlying sense of discontentment and dissatisfaction tends to arise. And that is often, we use work to kind of sort of, you know, paper over that, so we don't have to feel that sense of lack or sense of emptiness or sense of something not being there in our life. And again, it is if you work for that reason, it is not all that useful, because all you're doing is kind of hiding. You don't really want to face up to the reality of what is going on, and then it isn't very useful. So the idea here is to work in the right way, not to use it as an escape or as anything like that, but use it as a support for your practice, and then you're working in the right way. So that is about work, and it's quite an important one. It's very interesting, because sometimes people say, oh, at the time of the Buddha, they were so pure, you know, we should have all been born at the time of the Buddha. The reason today there is no chance, there's no Buddha around, everybody is so defiled, the Dhamma is going down. But when you read the Vinaya, right, when you read the suttas, that's exactly the feeling you get, because everybody is so pure, everybody is so wonderful in the suttas. These are kind of an expression of the Dhamma at its best. That's what the suttas are. Very interesting then to read the Vinaya, because the Vinaya is where all the rules are, all the monastic rules. And when you start to read the monastic rules, you know, and you start to see what the monks, the nuns, the lay people, what they were up to sometimes, you realize people were exactly the same then as they are now. And for example, in this case, about work, there's all these stories about this group of monks living in a certain place, and they were always doing building work, right? Famous for being builders. That was what their life consisted of, doing building kutis. And it's a bit like that. That's just like the tendency that monks sometimes have today in the present day. Exactly the same thing. It's kind of nice to see that, right? If you think that things were so special 2,500 years ago, then sometimes you just... you think, oh yeah, I don't need to practice these days because you can't get anywhere. But actually, that would be, I think, a misreading of the suttas and the Vinaya. Okay, as always, if you wish to ask any questions as we go along, please do so. So that is the very first quality. Then we have chattering, right? Another one of those things that we do to kind of paper over our inner kind of discontent and suffering. We talk a lot and talk, and when you stop talking, you kind of panic. What am I going to do now? You know, and sometimes you can see that, perhaps. And so another one of those things that is not very useful. And of course, the Buddhist idea of right speech is precisely to limit your conversations, limit talking, because that leads to more mindfulness and more clarity of mind than if you talk too much. Sleeping, same thing, right? Finding the right balance of sleep. Sleep too little doesn't work, sleep too much it doesn't work. Find the right balance where you kind of have the maximum amount of mindfulness. Company, similar to chattering, hanging out like just longing to hang out with people. Evil desires, papiccha, or bad desires if you like. And because we are here talking about monastics, the idea of bad desires here has a lot to do with kind of desires for fame, right? Desires for being perhaps well-liked, or desires for material things, right? I'm going to practice these ascetic practices so that I become really famous as a consequence. That kind of stuff. These are considered evil desires for a monastic, because they have nothing to do with the Buddhist path. In fact, they take you away from the Buddhist path if you have these kind of desires. And what you are doing, essentially, you are you're pursuing worldly things. These are exactly the things that people in the world pursue, right? Social position, status, material possessions, all of these kind of things. These are the things that people in the world pursue. And of course, if you do that as a monastic, we're supposed to go in a different direction. You're kind of missing out on what the monastic life really is all about. So that becomes problematic. Evil desires, it does sound pretty evil when you put it that way, but bad desires might be a better way of putting it, actually. And then we have mixing and associating with evil friends, bad friends. And again, so this here, what is a bad friend? And a bad friend is essentially somebody who leads you down towards evil desires, who kind of pulls you down that path. Papa-mitta is the Pali word, the exact opposite of kalyana-mitta. Papa and kalyana are opposites. Mitta is friend. Somebody who leads you towards those evil desires, who doesn't support you in your practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Who says, yeah, you know, if you break those precepts, it doesn't matter so much, you know. Sometimes it's necessary to have a bit of just enjoy yourself a little bit. You know, a drink here and drink there, what difference can it possibly make? Oh, yeah, we have a point. Okay, that's how you get led astray, right? This is how things kind of... We are so conditioned, right? And this is what happens sometimes. And then the last one was also a very interesting one, and this is not to rest content with partial achievements. And the Pali here seems to be saying, it's not just partial achievements as such, but it seems to be, I think it says, ora matta kena something. I haven't got the Pali with me here. But the idea seems to be that there are results that are on this side of real spiritual breakthroughs, right? In other words, they are the results of ordinary people, not the results that are linked to being a noble person or Aryan. So partial results here, you don't even break through and understand the teachings properly. You don't become a stream mentor or anything like that. This is what is really meant here, I think, by partial results. What that shows you is how important it is in Buddhism to actually see the Dhamma, that somebody sees the Dhamma and understands these teachings. This is so essential for the well-being of the Sangha, or the well-being of Buddhism overall. Because without somebody who is at least a stream mentor, who has seen these teachings and know what they are about, without that you don't really have any proper leadership, right? If there isn't somebody there who has the eyes, who have the, you know, the, being the eye of the world that the Buddha is called all the time in the suttas, without that eye of the world, somebody who understands and who can then impart that understanding to other people, without that everybody is really walking around in the dark, right? Of course, we have the suttas. The suttas are very useful. That, in a sense, is one eye, one way to help us move in the right direction. But another one is the people who actually have realized these teachings. And that is important for two reasons. First of all, it's very inspiring to meet people who really, you can feel that they have a degree of wisdom, you can feel that they have a degree of samadhi, right? People like Ajahn Brahm, and there are a few people, around the world. And when you are around people like that, you feel the teachings coming alive. There's a reality to them that otherwise can be very hard to grasp. But secondly, the second reason why it is important is because the suttas will tend to get colored by your views, right? You read the suttas in a certain way if your view is in a certain way, and you will tend to... You will tend to kind of distort the message in the suttas. You will read certain passages, put more emphasis on those, right? And there's always going to be some degree of distortion unless you have that right view yourself, unless you have understood what is in there. So because of that, it's easy to say, let's just read the suttas, but the reality is that there is also some degree of difficulty with that. You can get a lot out of it, but you may also sometimes misunderstand. And I'm sure you know what I mean, because you ask two different people about the meaning of a sutta passage, and sometimes they will give you conflicting answers, right? It means this. No, it means that. So who is right? And this is part of the problem here. So this shows you that the upholding, the future you know, the future of Buddhism actually really depends on these Aryans, these noble people who are there, who can help us, who can inspire us, who can help us interpret the teachings in the right way. This is actually such an important and basic part of the whole Buddhist path. You go and listen to the teaching of the Aryans, you think, yeah, this is the real deal. You listen to somebody else. Sometimes you think it's the real deal, but you know, maybe it isn't. And that's where you have to be careful. So that's an interesting set of dhammas as well, of qualities. But I'm going to go a little bit faster because otherwise it will take a long time to go get through all of this. So that is the first factors, or the second factor of seven. And then we have another factor of seven qualities. I will tell you another seven qualities conducive to welfare, etc., etc. As long as monks continue in faith, with modesty, with fear of wrongdoing, with learning, with aroused vigor, with established mindfulness, and with wisdom, as long as the monks hold to these seven qualities and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So these seven qualities are qualities that are, all of these are very common in the suttas. You see them almost everywhere. These are kind of core factors of the Buddhist path. And things like faith, for example, with saddha in Pali, is something that you see a lot. Learning, aroused vigor here is aradda virya, established mindfulness, sati, of course, wisdom, panya. Modesty is hiri, fear of wrongdoing, otapa. These are very important things. And faith is often one of the basic ones, right? Because without any kind of faith or confidence in these teachings, you don't really get started anywhere. You need to kind of listen to them and think, yeah, there's something to this. This makes sense. That's faith, right? Or you can call it confidence, if you like. And this faith aspect is something which starts the whole process off and makes the whole process kind of work in the right direction. So don't underestimate faith. Try to build up that sense of confidence. It's a very positive and beautiful thing. And there's two aspects to this idea of faith. And one is what sometimes is called like the cognitive aspect. But cognitive means the kind of rational aspect, right? Whereby you think, yeah, this really makes sense. This fits with my life experience, right? When you sit down and close your eyes, you actually do feel peaceful. Yeah, it works. But that's kind of the faith that comes from applying the teachings and seeing that there is some truth to that. There's a cognitive aspect, a recognition that there is truth in these things. I was saying on Friday night, I think one of the beautiful things about the wisdom, when the Buddha teaches on somebody else, is not so much that he is telling you something that you have no idea about. And something you think, yeah, well, I don't understand any of this. This is kind of, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I don't know. But it's more that the Buddha very often awakens a seed that is already there inside of us. That to me is the most powerful kind of wisdom. Right? So when you actually recognize and think, yeah, wow, that's really so true. I'm really glad I got to hear that. And it's put so beautifully by the Buddha. Now I understand it a bit more deeply. It reawakens something inside of you which is already there. That, I think, is the most important thing about wisdom. The most important thing that a teacher can do is awaken something in the student that the student already has potentially inside of them. And the reason why that is so much more powerful is because then it feels like it is yours. This is my understanding, right? When it's your wisdom being awakened, this is my understanding. And when it is your understanding, you have much more faith and belief in that understanding. This is the real deal. If somebody else tells you something which is hard to really grasp properly, and you don't really know whether it is, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, the kind of faith and confidence you have is much, much less. So this is the beautiful thing about the Dhamma. A lot of it is already comprehensible from the very beginning. It just reinforces the view, reinforces ideas that are already deeply buried in your heart and your mind. And it brings it up, brings it out. And you think, yeah, this is so good. This is so beautiful. And it means you put more faith in it because you know that the spiritual genius of the Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago, he's thinking a bit like you, right?
And if the Buddha is thinking a bit like you, and you have kind of, then of course that reinforces your own ideas massively, and then it's easy to put them into practice and these things. So that is a very important part of this idea of saddha, confidence in the word of the Buddha, seeing how it relates to your own understanding. Yeah. But another, yes, Yutong.
Yeah. Ask this so-called seed.
Yeah.
It appears to me as stemming from the learnings from past life, the association of Aryans from past life.
Yeah.
That's so-called a seed.
Yeah.
And then when we hear this.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's basically right. It would be, it comes from somewhere in the past life. You very usually, exactly, so when you hear it, and it kind of it brings it out again. Yeah, I would say that's basically probably right. Maybe you had a Buddhist teacher in a past life, maybe, you know, something like that. Or maybe it wasn't.
It seems to me that everything that is good, that is inherently good, must be from the Aryans in the first place.
Yeah, maybe not everything. I mean, I think a lot of things can also be things that are understood generally, you know, generally speaking. I mean, you have the whole Hindu culture, not Hindu, but the Brahmanical culture that existed in India prior to the Buddha. It was already on the many ways on the right track, right? They had many things that were good. Some of them were meditators. They got good meditation, maybe even deep samadhi states. Right? So the very fact that they were able to access those means they had at least something, doing something right there.
But I thought that must have stemmed from the Mohenjo-Daro's culture, which must have been the legacy of the Kashyapa Buddha.
Maybe. Possibly. But I'm not sure if there is how much evidence there is for that. I think that's kind of uncertain and very hard to kind of pin down. Maybe. Anything is possible. But I think that there are, you know, sometimes there are just wise people in the world who understand how to act roughly right, just from personal experience. Mm-hmm. You can deduce some of these things already. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, actually, I was going to talk about that. Does it differ from faith? The question is, does it differ from faith in other religions? Yes, it does. I think that's an important point. I was going to say something about that, but it didn't quite get there yet. But in most religions, faith is like the end, almost like the end point of the religion, right? That is kind of what you want to do. You want to have as much faith as possible. And in Christianity is famous for saying things like, if it doesn't matter if it's rational or irrational, that's kind of a test of your faith, right? If it's really rational, wow, then your faith is really strong because it's completely rational. When I hear that, I think, I don't want to have anything to do with that kind of religion personally. I find what are you talking about? That's what I tend to think. And so in Buddhism, the it's exact opposite. Your faith should be tempered by common sense, by rationality. You shouldn't test people's faith by making things as irrational as possible. If things are irrational, probably means there's some problem there. So I think this is a very important difference. I apologize if I haven't offended any Christians by being so blunt. But sometimes it just seems to me that this is just my own personal feelings. That, I think, is a very important point. Faith is something that grows with experience, grows with understanding, grows as your meditation improves. That is the right kind of faith. And eventually, that faith becomes confirmed faith. This is what is so special about the Buddhist thing as well. And when it's confirmed faith, it's confirmed because you have seen it fully for yourself. This is true. This is the way reality is. Right? So it's a very different type of faith, and I think that is a very important point. Blind faith is not encouraged at all, really, in the Buddhist teachings. So great. So thanks for that. But the other thing about faith, one is what I just said now, which is like the cognitive or the rational aspect of the faith, where you scrutinize the teachings and you feel, wow, this is just good. But there is another aspect to the Buddhist faith as well, and this is probably an aspect which is true across all kinds of faith, whatever religion you are dealing with, and that is the emotional aspect of faith. And this is actually also extremely important on the Buddhist path. And this is this feeling that you are in the presence of something really powerful and really beautiful. Right? This feeling that these teachings, they really have the potential to change my life, to move my life towards more happiness and contentment and away from suffering and problems. It's what everybody wants. And there it is. For the first time in your life, you have actually found something that can fulfill that need, that yearning inside of all of us to move towards some kind of real happiness and away from all the problems and suffering. And once you get that feeling, of course, you feel a sense of joy, right? Because you have found, in a sense, the very the answer to the meaning of life itself. That is how it seems. And of course, once you feel that, then of course you gain this enormous respect for the Buddha. That's when you become a real disciple. Here is a teacher who actually has something to teach you that is profoundly useful in your life. Teachings are very beautiful. There is a Sangha out there who's practicing these teachings already in the right way. And you get the sense of, can get this sense of joy when you reflect on these things in the right way. And that is the emotional side of faith. And that emotional side is very important because it can be the basis for meditation practice. Right? You sit down and you somehow get into the right mood. You think about these teachings. You understand how incredibly precious it is. How this is really what you've been looking for all along. And then because you do that, joy starts to arise. When joy arises, that joy is a type of joy which is spiritual and not a worldly kind of joy. Because of that, it purifies the mind. The defilements cannot be in the mind at the same time as you have this kind of spiritual joy. Because it purifies the mind, you are very, very close towards going very deep in meditation practice already, right? When that joy arises, just close your eyes. And just relax and just enjoy it. Watch the breath perhaps, right, together with that joy. And then the whole process can just take off on that basis. And you see this throughout the suttas. This is one of the ways the Buddha recommends in so many places how meditation actually works and how it kind of starts off and then carries on through this whole process of joy arising and then going inside of yourself, closing your eyes and meditating on that basis. So this is very important as well. So there's two aspects of faith that comes out here. So then we have modesty, it says here. The Pali word for this is hiri. We are still on paragraph 1-8. And hiri in Pali is usually here translated as shame. That's the normal translation. I know that the recent other translations possible, one of the possible ones is conscience, right? A sense of conscience. In other words, conscience is like something inside that, I shouldn't do this. This is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. That's conscience, right? Stay away from that. That is considered bad. That's conscience. So what does it actually mean? And I think it's probably conscience is probably more correct, because conscience is an internal thing towards yourself that you feel like this is kind of beneath me, right? This is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. And if you do it regardless of a conscience, you feel like dirtied afterwards. You feel you've done something to yourself which is not good, right? So notice those feelings. Very useful to notice that, because when you notice that, it becomes an additional motivation to stay away from doing what is bad, because it feels kind of yucky if you do something which isn't nice. But there's also another aspect to shame, and that is what we might more call the social aspect of shame, right? When you're in the company of other people, you don't want to do anything bad, right? Because other people might see you. There's some very interesting experiments apparently done on that with people, and it is shown that almost everybody in the world, they are more moral. They live better lives when other people are around, right? People have to think, oh, okay, I've got to behave now. Because it's like a kind of a social, you feel kind of, you know, the pressure of the people around you to do what is that. You want to look good, right? Even though you're kind of not all that good inside, at least you want to look good outside, right? This is the social aspect of being human. So very often we are actually more, that is one of the restraints on us, is that, or constraints on us, that externally people are looking at us and we feel ashamed if somebody sees us doing something bad. That is also perhaps a small aspect of this. And this is one of the great reasons reasons. Why it is good to hang out in a Buddhist community, right? You think, oh, what will all these good Buddhists around me think if I do that? Should I say that? No, I can't say that because all these other good Buddhists, they will feel really, they will think I'm a terrible person. Okay, I better restrain myself. And then perhaps you take those ideas back into your private life as well, right? Because you had them in the, when you were around other people, perhaps. But the main point here is the idea of an internal voice, the conscience. That is the main thing that this talks about. So conscience, again, is something that we can build up, right? Like all of these qualities. You build it up in the sense that you understand in a deeper level what morality actually is. So your conscience kind of spreads out into new areas. And this is how you develop the idea of conscience. Then we have the ottapada, which is here called the fear of wrongdoing. And this is just the knowledge that wrong actions have bad results, right? So when you do something bad, it will end up having a bad effect on you. This is the fear of wrongdoing. And again, as I have mentioned here before many times, one of the great ways of doing that is just to feel the immediate repercussions, the immediate effect that an act has on you right here and right now. Do something bad, it doesn't feel good. Do something good. Sometimes you feel really joyous and happy when you do something kind, right? Look at those effects in yourself. Understand that. And then you have a basis for this ottapa here, the fear of the consequences of things. These are sometimes called the guardians of the world, here ottapa, because they guard the world from too much badness, I suppose. Then we have learning is the next one. Bahusutta, somebody who has heard much. Right? Interesting that learning is actually a part of these qualities that lead to non-decline, right? What does learning really mean? And of course, in this case, Bahusutta, having heard much, basically means having heard much of the Buddha's teachings. And especially then what we call the EBTs, the early Buddhist texts, having heard a lot, having heard not necessarily a lot, could mean a lot, but at the very least, in depth, some of those teachings. At the very least, it means that. So that means it's good, right, to read a few suttas. It's good to come to the sutta class every now and again. Good to read a bit of suttas at home sometimes if you have the time to get inspired, because you become bahusutta. You become learned in these things, and then as a consequence, you become somebody who helps carrying Buddhism. Supporting Buddhism for the future. Of course, especially useful for monastics, because this is what we're supposed to do, right? This is kind of our livelihood, so an important factor there. Then we have aroused vigor. This is aradda virya. Virya is this Pali word which means like energy, right? So you have energy in the mind. And the main meaning of that is that, you know, sometimes the mind is naturally energetic. Right, you feel kind of energy inside. You wake up in the morning, you're kind of ready for the day. You feel energy. It doesn't mean so much that you apply yourself or you strive, but more the natural energy that is in the mind when the mind is in a good space. Right, when you feel happy, you feel kind of mindful, you feel energetic. You want to kind of get out there and do the right things in the world. You feel a natural kind of energy. That is the main meaning of that one. With that often comes mindfulness, right? Mindfulness, one of those crucial aspects on the Buddhist path. You get it in varying degrees, but mindfulness is always necessary to some extent, because mindfulness is what tells you whether you are right now, you're doing the right thing or not. It tells you whether you're heading in the right direction. It allows you to react differently in a particular situation. Right, you're about to say something good, mindfulness says, wait a minute, hold on, check it out first of all. And then you kind of hold back a little bit. So mindfulness comes in a large number of degrees. It's one of the important things to understand. And the higher the degree of mindfulness, the more power it has to see things rightly in the right way, eventually becoming so powerful that you can see things in accordance with reality. Yata, bhuta, jnana, dasana. Large number of degrees. And this is what you find in the suttas as well, that actually talks about mindfulness quite specifically like that. So the more powerful the mindfulness, after you come out of deep meditation, mindfulness is often very powerful. And the last one here is the wisdom faculty here.
And wisdom faculty here is the most profound one. And here it is very similar to the last factor of the previous seven sets, which was about not to rest content with partial achievements, because the wisdom faculty really is precisely that insight into the teachings of the Buddha. And when I say that, I mean specifically the understanding of the human mind, right? Understanding the ideas of impermanence, non-self, etc., especially. So having a profound insight into that, because again, this is what stabilizes everything else. Once that insight is into place, the whole teachings kind of fall in behind that, and you know how everything else works out. So the highest kind of these supporting factors that lead Buddhism on the right track for the future. Yes, sir. Yes, okay, I'll repeat the question. Is this wisdom here synonymous with seeing things as they really are? And I would say yes. It is basically probably synonymous with that. But I think what we're talking about here, seeing things as they really are, it comes again in varying degrees. So here we are talking about a fairly deep seeing of things as they really are. Right? So normally in the suttas, you have, when you come out of samadhi, you see things as they really are, because the hindrances are no longer there. So there's nothing to distort anything here. But just that bare fact that you see things as they actually are doesn't mean that you have yet the profoundest understanding of the five khandhas. Then you have to investigate the five khandhas and see what the consequences are. And that is where the real wisdom becomes really established. So what is going on here? What does this specifically refer to? It's difficult to say very specifically. It could refer to stream entry. It could refer to some preliminary insights prior to stream entry. They talk in the suttas about the wisdom of arising and passing away, which is very probably very similar to stream entry, but perhaps it means those on the path to stream entry, saddhanusari, dhammanusari, or something like that. But I think it's quite likely to refer to the Aryans, at least in some way, one way or another. Someone was on the path somewhere. Yes. Yeah. The microphone isn't very popular, is it? People, that makes it... Okay. So, great. So that is the wisdom faculty when it is really properly, fully developed. Okay. So, then... we come to another seven factors, and these are the seven factors of awakening, right? Another very interesting set. You can see here how all these various sets of seven are kind of been thrown together in a way. And these seven sets factors of awakening are as follows. So these are the other seven things that are conducive to welfare, etc. And as long as the monks develop the awakening factor of mindfulness, the awakening factor of the investigation of phenomena, the awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of delight or pity, awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of stillness, and the awakening factor of equanimity. These are the seven factors of awakening. And the reason why they are called the seven factors of awakening is because these are specifically the things that lead to awakening, that take you directly there. They are the causes and conditions directly that you end up being, you know, enlightened, or whatever word you prefer to translate this with. So the first one here is the enlightenment. I'm going to have a quick look at this because they're actually quite interesting, these factors of awakening. I'm not going to look at them in great depth, but they are, I think, quite interesting regardless. And perhaps the first thing I should say is that these seven factors of awakening, they are very similar to what is sometimes called dependent liberation. That's what I have called it sometimes. And dependent liberation is this sequence of phenomena or sequence in the mind, right? How the mind, qualities of the mind, that start off with sila, and from sila it goes all the way up to awakening itself. This is one of the suttas I always read out on the retreats when I do the sutta meditation and sutta retreats. And it's very beautiful, and it shows the whole psychological process, how awakening happens.
you start off by doing the right thing, living a good life, being habitually virtuous and good person. From that, you then get non-regret. From the non-regret comes the gladness. Then comes the piti, which is also mentioned here. The sukha, pasadi, which is mentioned here. Stillness, which is also mentioned here, right? And then from that comes then the seeing things according to reality. That can be similar to the upeka, the equanimity, which is mentioned here. And then from that comes the nibbida, which is like the repulsion from the world. When you see things according to reality and you see what suffering is all about, you are repelled by that. Nobody wants to suffer, right? So are you repelled by this idea of suffering? When you are repelled by suffering, you have viraga, which viraga is like the giving up of desire for that. How can you desire suffering? It's impossible. We always want to desire the opposite. So your craving dies down, and from that, liberation, vimutti, happens as a consequence. And that whole sequence of dependent liberation is very similar to these seven sambhujangas that we have here, enlightenment factors. They're very, they're slightly different. Slight different sequence, some new factors in there, but essentially it is the same sequence that we are seeing. Right? And this tells you, it tells you two things. It tells you how important both of those sequences are, because they're both pointing to the same thing. Of course, the seven factors of awakening here, they are part of what is known as the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, which are the 37 aids to awakening, which, as we shall see later on, is one of the core groupings of what the Buddha's teaching is all about, right? So we're here talking about very core teachings of Buddhism. And so because of that, these things kind of support each other, show how important all of these factors really are, because they are variations on a theme. They are roughly the same thing, same ideas going on. So that is the first thing that is interesting here. This dependent liberation and the bhujangas are very closely related to each other. So how does it work? And the way it works is that this is a conditioned sequence, one thing leading to the next one. So much in the Dhamma is precisely that, conditioned sequences, things leading stage by stage, one thing to the next one, right? One thing is in place, it becomes the cause for the second one, a second one becomes the cause for the third one. And the reason why that is so is because that is how the world operates. It operates at phenomena being conditioned by each other. So by using that idea of conditionality, we can make things happen according to these laws of conditionality here. So the first one here, it starts off with a sati sambhujanga, the enlightenment factor of awakening factor of mindfulness. And that is nothing different than the satipatthanas. Right? Satipatthana practice, the four applications of mindfulness, right? Please, if I use too many Pali words, please stop me. Some of you may not be as used to Pali as some others. So please stop me if I forget to say the right thing. But so the applications of mindfulness, which is basically what meditation is all about, right? When you do mindfulness of breathing, you are doing satipatthana practice. You're doing the application of mindfulness, applying the mindfulness to the breath. This is where this starts. It starts with the basic meditation practice of like watching the breath. This is where it all begins. And you may think, well, that's really basic. I can do that. I can do this mindfulness factor of awakening, right? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. It's not as obvious as it may seem, because remember that mindfulness of breathing actually is not a very easy thing to do if you are going to do it properly. Yeah. Mindfulness of breathing done properly is actually quite a profound thing and quite a difficult thing to do. I think one of the most problematic things in meditation practice, people go too quickly to the object of meditation, go too quickly to the breath, jump onto the breath. You know, people say, oh yeah, I just grab hold of the breath, sit down, close my eyes, grab hold of the breath. That's what I do in meditation. Well, I wouldn't recommend that, because if you do that, you probably are not really ready to watch the breath in the right way. The way to watch the breath is to sit back, relax, find the ease in the body, allow mindfulness to arise naturally. And when mindfulness arises naturally, the breath comes to you rather than the other way around. That is the ideal way, because otherwise you tend to use too much force and too much power in your meditation practice. It becomes unpleasant and it doesn't really work properly. And this is what I mean by breath meditation being profound, right? You should wait for the breath to come to you rather than going grabbing onto the breath. The fact that you grab onto it means it's probably not the right way. So the idea, this is why these things are actually, the Sambhujanga of Sati, the mindfulness awakening factor, actually is quite profound. So once you are doing that, then the next factor here is the investigation of phenomena. This is the Dhammavicaya Sambhujanga. And what that really means is understanding the refined problems in the mind, the refined defilements, the refined hindrances that block you from going further down on the path of meditation practice. Right? So when you meditate, you're watching the breath, you will see that you are not making enough progress. Why isn't the breath becoming more refined? Why isn't the joy arising? What's going on here? And as you investigate it, this investigational phenomena, as you investigate your experience in terms of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is dark, what is bright, what is etc., etc., what is blameworthy and unblameworthy, I think is the terms used in this particular case. As you investigate that, you start to understand how the process of meditation works. You understand your own mind, where the problems are, what is blocking you. This is this investigation we talk about very often, right, in meditation practice, understanding what is happening within yourself. And this happens as you meditate and you come out after, what do you think? What happened there? You may have noticed that if you have done a bit of meditation with me before, usually at the end of the meditation I say, well, think back on the meditation. Did it work? Why did it work? Why did it not work? What is going on there? And you look back and you investigate, and then you see what the blockages are. You understand how you can overcome those blockages and how you can kind of move on, hopefully, in the future. This is part of that process, in a sense, and we can use that process from the very beginning. But at this point, it becomes very much more powerful because you're getting very close to real meditation, real deep meditation as a consequence. Yes.
Ajahn Brahmali, these seven factors of enlightenment, awakening or bhujangas, they're very important, you know. It is said mentioned in the suttas that when the Buddha was sick, I think Chunda recited this thing, you know, and he was healed. And when one of the monks, I think, was it Chunda or was sick? He recited this and he was healed.
The Buddha was healed, yeah.
Yeah, it seems that it's got some healing power. So in your explanation to us, can you also relate to the healing thing, how it can heal us? Because, you know, and some of the monks, you know, when people sick, they recite these seven bhujangas, you know.
Thank you. Thanks, Eddie. It's very interesting, isn't it, that you actually, and that's actually not only one, there's three different suttas where they talk about that you recite the bhujangas, and then afterwards, you know, the Buddha says to it's very strange, the Buddha says to this monk Chunda, oh, you know, recite the bhujangas for me, he's sick, he recites the bhujangas, then he's okay.
And thank you.
Very interesting idea. Yeah,
you're saying that this is linked to the dependent origination.
Dependent liberation, we can
get healing from the the dependent origination, these conditions that, you know, okay, so if this ceases, that ceases, that's healing, so thanks for telling us, okay, so I could see the link, you know.
Yeah, okay, good, yeah. I didn't actually say dependent origination, I said dependent liberation, which is a slightly different sequence, but it's also a conditioned sequence in a similar way, so they kind of relate to each other, so, yeah.
Thanks, this is very important one.
Good, okay, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I think we'll leave that for now, Eddie, because I'm not sure exactly how that works. It's a slightly mysterious thing that you can chant these bhujangas and then somehow you get out of illness. I'm not entirely clear about that myself. But I think sometimes it's just that the joy of the Dhamma has so much power, you know. And sometimes you feel maybe very weak, you can't really recite them properly or whatever, and you hear it from somebody else, and it reminds you of the power of the Dhamma, reminds you of something very beautiful. And we all know that when we are happy and we feel content with life, a sense of joy, we tend to fare better in the world, right? We tend to kind of, you know, people in hospital who have a positive mindset, they are quicker to kind of get out of hospital and the wounds or whatever heal more quickly. So the mind is very important, has a very important effect on the body. So it could be as simple as that, just here in the Dhamma, and these are some of the most profound Dhammas around, right? So because of that, that could be the reason. But it is regardless slightly mysterious, I have to admit. The next thing that comes here after that is the awakening factor of energy, right? So when you investigate these phenomena, when you investigate your meditation practice, and you are able to overcome those final hindrances, the purpose of the investigation, not to investigate for the sake of investigating, but to enable you to make progress. So because that is what happens, that is when energy arises. Energy is a natural quality of being energized, often comes with joy, often comes with strong mindfulness, that arises in the mind when the hindrances die down, or die down almost completely. Joy happens as natural in a mind where there's no hindrances. So this is why this is happening at this place. I said joy, I should say energy. Energy is natural. So mind is very, and it becomes energetic at this particular point. And then, together with the energy in the mind, as I just said, often comes the joy, right? The piti, which is here called delight, right? And then the rest of the things that you see here are all factors in meditation practice, things that you will see in your own mind when meditation is going really, really well. These are the things that you will see as part of the progress in meditation. The delight when it becomes deepened and leads on to a deep sense of tranquility, right? A very deep sense of peace. And that deep sense of peace eventually then issues in stillness, in samadhi. When you kind of mind becomes very one-pointed, you kind of become one with the object of your meditation, all of that, you know? Get very powerful mental states. And of course, those mental states at the most powerful become the equanimity where the mind has this complete evenness. And the idea of equanimity, the reason why it is so powerful is because, first of all, the mind is incredibly even and completely balanced. And because it is so balanced, you have this ability to stand back and watch and observe things without being touched by the things you are observing. You may be observing things that seem difficult and unpleasant to grasp, right? Like seeing impermanence and non-self. It can be very hard, or seeing suffering. So you need a very powerful and balanced mind to be able to see that. So the word upekkha, which is behind equanimity here, has both of these meanings. It has a meaning of evenness. Also has the meaning of looking on at the same time. And it is from that evenness and looking on, that is where the breakthrough and the full awakening happen. And this is how these things support that. Okay, so that is a little bit about the Bhojangas. And as Eddie kindly pointed out, they also have this other remarkable quality of sometimes healing you, but I think you have to have a lot of confidence in them before they actually work like that. Then we have another seven things. There's a lot of content here, right? Really heaps of content on this one. But we'll just keep on going. So another seven things, as long as the monks develop the perception of impermanence, of non-self, of impurity, of danger, of overcoming, of dispassion, of cessation, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So here we are really getting into the kind of deeper aspects of the Dhamma. These are kind of the things that monastics are supposed to do ideally in their meditation practice, and hopefully one day go to some of these very profound perceptions here. I'll explain to you in brief what is going on, because it's always interesting and it's always part of the Dhamma, of course. Perception of impermanence. You can develop this perception in many different ways, just by looking at how the impermanence of things in your life, but ultimately the purpose of the perception of impermanence is to see the five khandhas, to see your own mind, right? Your own experience of the world, to see that as impermanent. That is the most, that is kind of where it kind of heads towards, where you really want to get eventually. Yeah. So seeing your own experience as impermanent, and already we know that that is true to a very large extent. Experience is always changing. The world is always changing here. Yeah. But you want to take it to the point where you see everything in your experience, absolutely everything, as being impermanent, including all the aspects of your own mind. And that is where it really has power. And the way to do that is usually just meditation practice, right? You practice, you're watching the breath, and as you watch the breath, you see things becoming simplified and becoming, there's less and less things going on. Certain things are abandoned, like the senses starting to disappear, the hindrances going, and all of that. And then when you come out of the meditation afterwards, you look back on your meditation experience and you see how things changed, how they disappeared, and how impermanent they were. And that is when you have this perception of impermanence, seeing this, seeing the nature of things disappearing. The most powerful way of understanding impermanence is not just seeing that people come, not people, but things coming and going. The most powerful way of seeing it is when things disappear completely as they can in meditation practice. Then they are really drives home the point that things are impermanent. Non-self, perception of non-self is very similar to that one, because impermanence and non-self are very closely related to each other. But usually the perception of non-self is related to the six senses, right? So seeing, smelling, tasting, all of this, the six, including the mind, so six senses, and you investigate those things as non-self. And one of the most important aspects of non-self is that we don't, in the end, we don't have any control over what comes in, how we experience the world, right? Our sense of control is vastly overestimated. And if we could control everything, we would just experience good things, right? But we can't. We have to. An important aspect of life is always that there is a degree of suffering there, and you can't get away from that. And that shows you that there is, the control we have is limited. So by seeing the non-self aspect of the six senses, it means that you understand that you don't have any final control over these six senses. They are just phenomena, they are experiences that happen, and they sometimes happen against your wishes. And that's why there is suffering in the world, that's why there is problems. So that is, the again, the perception of non-self, perception of impurity. This is the asubha, basically means looking at the body, seeing the unpleasant aspects of the body. Seeing the body, especially seeing the internal body, right? All the various kind of internal organs and things like that, and seeing it from that point of view rather than seeing it from external point of view. That's usually when we think of the body as beautiful, but it's much more difficult to look at all the internal aspects and consider the body beautiful. So, but this is very much a monastic practice, and a practice for those who are really kind of going very deeply into the Dhamma. The practice of the perception of danger is a similar kind of thing. Is the danger, these perceptions are found in the sutta called the Girimananda Sutta in the Anguttara 10, number 60. You can have a look at them there if you wish. But the perception of danger is the understanding that the body, there's all kinds of things that will can happen to the body. Illnesses in particular, right? Has this long list of illnesses there. The danger in the body, you never know what's going to happen next. It doesn't just happen to other people, it happens to everyone, and that's part of the problem. The perception of coming, pahana sanya, and this is the perception or the idea that when there are negative thoughts arising in the mind, ill will, harming, sensual desires, then the perception of overcoming is the idea of overcoming those thoughts. So this is a very useful one, right? It's useful for everybody to do, especially ill will, how to overcome ill will. So have that perception inside of you, the idea that you want to overcome these things. How can you overcome ill will, right? One of the things that we talk about quite a lot, because it is one of the most useful aspects, I think, on the Buddhist path, to help us overcome these negative mind states. And also they give very quick results. You feel very good if you are able to overcome ill will. You feel life becomes much more easy and pleasant if you do that.
the perception of dispassion and of cessation, these are essentially the same perceptions. These are very profound things. And this is the understanding, as it says elsewhere, that basically the overcoming of all attachments, right? The ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. This is the highest, this is the best. So the idea here is to base, this is almost like you're contemplating nibbana itself, understanding that as things cease, things tend to become better. You can see that in your meditation practice, right? The simpler things are, the less things are going on, the more happy you feel, right? You get this feeling that actually when things stop, it's actually a good thing. It kind of goes against our ordinary way of thinking. But once you get into meditation, you kind of understand why that is the case. That is it as far as these seven perceptions are concerned. So this is quite profound stuff, but nevertheless, it is interesting here. Okay, there then comes a set of six qualities. It is the last set of qualities, and I will have a look at that one as well. This is a very useful thing and has much more practical consequences. Question, sorry. John, yeah.
Veeral, could you go through equanimity again, please, if you don't mind?
Equanimity. Okay, so equanimity, the equanimity awakening factor, upeka sambojanga. Equanimity is used in many different ways. Sometimes equanimity is just used in like the equanimity of daily life. We don't get carried away by the senses, right? Your mind is kind of even. You don't allow yourself to get too angry, too carried away by desire for things. That is a kind of low kind of equanimity here. But as you get to samadhi, as your meditation really becomes profound, you get the equanimity of the jhanas, for example, especially the high jhanas. And that is the equanimity where the mind is powerful enough to actually be able to make, you know, to see things according to reality. That's where awakening really becomes possible. And there's two facets to that equanimity. One is the fact that the mind is incredibly even. You have gone beyond happiness and pleasure at this point, right? Your mind is completely, there's no... And this is one of those kind of remarkable things about the Dhamma. When you go beyond the experience, direct experience of happiness, you feel even more happy. It's one of those incredible things that are very hard to get one's mind around. And because you've gone beyond all happiness and pleasure, your mind is almost completely imperturbable. That's one of the qualities of that mind. It's called imperturbable mind, because you are beyond, you can't really be touched by happiness and pain anymore at all. Mind is very even. Because it is even, you can stand back and you can watch, right? This is one of the meanings of upeka. Upeka is derived from upa prefix, I think it is in this case. Upeka, actually not sure, probably upa plus pekati. Pekati means just to watch. So you watch with evenness. You watch with a mind that is unperturbed, a mind which doesn't move. That is the main meaning there. So you have an able, usually when we watch things in the world, we get carried away by our vested interests, by desires, by anger, and these kind of things. When the mind is completely even, there's no defilements there, you can see things without blinking and take them aboard for what they actually are. That is kind of the point here of that sambojanga. Yeah? And that is why awakening is possible at that point. You can deal with it. It's very hard, otherwise very hard to deal with these things. Okay. So, now let us move on to these other six qualities. And these are really nice qualities. These are some of my favorites, some of the things that we have looked at now. Some of them are a little bit theoretical, perhaps, but these are things that get straight back to practice and how we can deal with things in life. And it's interesting here, all the quantities so far, there's been seven of this, seven of that, etc. Now, suddenly six, right? This is the only set of six among all of these sets. And because it is the only set of six, I think it is quite likely that this may actually have belonged to the sutta from the very beginning.
The fact that you add more sets of seven kind of makes sense. It just follows on from the previous ones. But the set of six doesn't naturally follow on from the other sets of seven. So for that, I think it may actually be original. And it is also found in other versions of the sutta, which kind of supports that. And this is a set of six you find also elsewhere. And this is a set that is called precisely the things that lead to harmony, lead to unity, and all of these kind of things in the Dhamma. So very important. It is phrased for the monastics as usual, but actually, of course, it is important for everybody can use these qualities in their life. So, monks, I will tell you six things that are conducive to communal living. Why has he abbreviated so much? We don't really have all the details here. It would be really nice to have some of the more details. Very, very abbreviated. Okay, they are conducive to communal living, to unity and harmony, something like that, if I remember from the other suttas. It's found also in Majjhima Nikaya 48, if you want to look it up at some stage. So what are these things? And these are as follow: as long as the monks, both in public and in private, show loving kindness to their fellows in acts of body, speech and thought. So there you are. These are the three first ones. They are kind of combined together into one. Acts of loving kindness through body, through speech, and also through mind, through thought. Right? And there's many interesting points about this. But one of the interesting points, of course, is the idea how loving kindness is used here. The word here is metta, exactly what we expect to find. And the way it is used here is in a much more simple way than ordinarily how we think about metta. Often think about metta sitting down, spreading it out to the four directions or intermediate directions or whatever it is. But here it has to do with how we treat people in ordinary life. And I think this is such an important thing, right? This is the basic metta. This is the metta that actually empowers the meditation later on, that enables us to actually make the meditation work at the later stage. This is the foundation. And this is where really the other metta of meditation practice really is built from this. So treat other people with kindness, right? And this kind of also dovetails, if you like, with the precepts. The precepts are, don't do the bad things. This is the opposite. Do the good stuff. Right? So these things go together, of course. So not only, as I always say, don't do the bad, but also do the good. And this is where you find that. So treating people with kindness, with metta, this is where metta starts. And if we haven't really built a foundation in that, it's going to be very hard to do metta as a meditation topic, at least to any particular depth. So that's a very important thing, right? To remember these things. Not something that you perhaps will hear that often, but here you have the Buddha saying that. Then, of course, is this idea that is both in public and in private, right? So there's a sense of integrity there. You always act in this way. You always think in this way, wherever you are. You don't just kind of smile in public and then kind of grumble behind the back, or you know, that sort of stuff. But you have a kind of the right perception all the way through. Then. What is also interesting here is that it is towards your fellows, the sabrahmacharya, your fellow monastics is quite literally what that means. So the emphasis here, which is interesting, is that this should be towards your fellow monastics, right? Or for lay people, your whoever are the people close around you who support you, whether here at the Buddhist Society or in your family life and that sort of thing. The people who are closest to us. And I think that is another interesting thing, because very often in life it is the people who are closest to us where it is most difficult to always have loving kindness, right? And you know, when you live with monks all the time, you know, and I live with Mudu for 5 years now, and Mudu is a really good monk, it's very hard to fault find, but you know, when you live on top of each other all the time, there's always sometimes a bit of friction. It's almost completely unavoidable. It's just the nature of things. So that is why it is so important to develop that sense of loving kindness with those people who are closest to you. Because if you have harmony with those people, That is when meditation becomes possible. If I have harmony with everyone here when I come to Dhammaloka Center, and I go back to the monastery and argue with everyone in the monastery, it's not going to work, right? Because it means that you have no peace, you have no tranquility in the monastery. It's more important to have harmony in the monastery than it is when I come here. So it's here I should really argue. I should argue with you guys, right? But not with the monks in the monastery here. And it's much easier to kind of come here to Dhammaloka Center. I only see you maybe once a month or something. Very easy to be friendly, right? Because you don't see each other so much. The really hard one is much more difficult when people are close to you. So you focus in those relationships that really matter, where harmony is really important because it supports your practice. It's interesting, right? So it kind of shows you again where the emphasis really needs to be put. So, and then of course, not just in body, right, but in speech and also in thought, right? This is one of the most difficult ones of all, but even in thought. Watch your mind, see how it thinks. Okay, I'm thinking negative. Well, first of all, when you think something negative about somebody, don't kind of crush it and think, oh, this is bad, I'm a bad Buddhist. And you kind of crush it and you kind of crush mind with mind, because that just leads to repression and it kind of worsens the situation if you do that. So when you have a bad thought, think, big deal, this is life. Life is like this. This can be expected. Now, how can I deal with this? How can I change this? How can I look at this person in a new way? Right? You stand back, you are cool about your bad thoughts. You're not kind of jumping onto yourself straight away and saying, bad person, because that is not going to get you anywhere. You stand back and say, okay, this is not ideal. How can I deal with this? Then you will have make progress in overcoming your bad thoughts. Not by judging yourself harshly. It's never going to work. Okay, so very, very beautiful, these qualities are conducive to harmony and unity and communal living here. And then we have the next one here, which is you share with your virtuous fellow monastics whatever you receive as a rightful gift, including the contents of the alms bowls, right? You don't keep it to yourself, right? So again, the sharing, again, with your fellow monastics, it makes kind of sense because your fellow monastics are in the same situation as you. It doesn't make all that much sense to share it with the lay people because they have usually given you these things in the first place. So it's not so obvious. And it's a very beautiful gesture, right? If you have something extra and you give it to your fellow monastics, it tends to, again, create a sense of bonding, a sense of commonality when you're able to do that. Even the content of your alms bowl, right? We usually tend to get the same food because the food is there on the table, everybody takes their thing. But in the old days, when you went on alms round, sometimes the monks would get very different food. And because the food was different, it was nice to be able to share what you got with somebody else if you had something special. Even today, even nowadays, we sometimes can do that, but especially in those days. And the Buddha has a really beautiful saying, which I think is in the Itavuttaka or something like that, where he says that if you, whoever that is, if you understood the benefit and the power of giving in the same way as I do, you would never have a single meal without sharing it with somebody else. Right? So powerful is the act of sharing and giving. So much happiness and joy can be derived from that. That will then support your meditation, etc., and all the other stuff. So generosity, again, it shows you what an important aspect of the path this is. And of course, here we also see that it is part of monastic life as well. Sometimes people say, oh, giving is what the lay people do, the monks practice meditation, but it isn't like that. Everybody does everything. Because if you don't do these foundational things, if you don't build these up to become stronger and stronger, then even as a monastic, you will stunt your progress in the Dhamma. You will stop. You won't be able to achieve the meditation that you should be aiming for. So very important all the way along, right? The whole path is part of this. So you don't hold anything back. And this little thing, which is also very nice, this idea of a rightful gift, right? A rightful gift here means a gift that you deserve, a gift that you have got because you are doing the right thing and not the wrong thing. right? So if you live your monastic life well and people are inspired and they give you gifts as a consequence of that, that is called a rightful gift. Right? If you live your life as a scallywag and you kind of look kind of good in public and people give you gifts, well, it's not really a rightful gift. And there's something very powerful about that. A rightful gift is a gift that you feel you deserve. And because you feel you deserve it in a sense, it's very powerful to give it away. Because you feel that you are, you know, in a sense, this is really yours, you're worthy of this. And for that reason, it's very powerful to give it away to others. And it's exactly the same thing in lay life. You know, if you have kind of gone somewhere and maybe you have stolen something, it doesn't really feel like it belongs to you in the first place. So giving it away is not going to have that much power. But if you have worked really hard for something, you had to make the money, and then you purchase something on that basis, and then you give it to somebody else. It's a very powerful feeling because you really feel you deserve that thing that you then give away. Then that kind of giving is much more powerful, because you actually are really renouncing something which really is yours in a certain sense. Really is yours. I say that in quotation marks because in the end, nothing is really yours quite in that way, but at least you feel you're worthy of that thing. Yeah. So there's a little nice little thing that is the idea of the rightful gift, right? These are the things that are really, really powerful here. So, there you are, the idea of generosity. When we share with each other in this way, we create a strong sense of community, of bonding as a consequence. Then we have the next one. Keep consistently the unbroken and unaltered, those rules of conduct that are spotless, liberating, praised by the wise, unstained and conducive to stillness. And persist therein with your fellows both in public and in private. So here we are talking about the virtue, the sila. So you practice the sila. This is the Arya sila that the Aryans practice. And we try to emulate that to the best of our ability, to be as spotless and stainless in our conduct as possible. In the Patimokkha for the monks and the little chant we do at the beginning, it says, Anumatesu vajesu bayadasavi, seeing danger even in slight faults. Because every time you do a slight mistake, you're dragging yourself down and you're blocking your progress towards meditation and awakening. So you try to avoid even the slightest faults, right? This is what is meant here by the spotless and unstained virtue. And if you do make a mistake, then it is always the monastic way is then to atone for that, to confess what you have done. And if you don't confess, that also is going to block you on the path, right? This is an important part of this. Interesting how these things are called liberating. When you are virtuous, you feel free, right? Virtue is not a constraint, it's not something that ties you down and binds you, anything like that. Virtue is something that makes you feel free. And this is this is one of those things that sometimes people don't understand. They think, oh, I don't want to keep all these rules, right? Virtue is like a constraint on my life. But actually, it is a constraint right there and then. But in the long run, it makes you feel free. It makes you feel mentally free. All those things that just drag you down mentally, make you feel dark and remorseful inside, all of that is removed. And that mental freedom, far more important than any kind of freedom we have in the present moment to do what we like. That's irrelevant. The mental freedom is what really matters. That's what we should strive for. That is real freedom. The other stuff is Mickey Mouse freedom. No need for that Mickey Mouse freedom. It doesn't say that in the sutta. That's just my addition. Okay. And it is conducive to samadhi, right? This is one of the things I just said the other day, that if your meditation isn't getting together, if your samadhi isn't coming together, why is it? And here you see it again. The reason is most likely because your sila isn't good enough yet. There's something you haven't done. There's some degree of purity you haven't achieved. You need to look at yourself, right? As they say, brutally honest, because sometimes it's a bit brutal when you kind of have to acknowledge that maybe you aren't absolutely perfect. You shouldn't feel bad about that, right? I mean, who is absolutely perfect in this world? But anybody who comes here to the Buddhist Society is already incredibly good people already. But we shouldn't be surprised that we're not perfect. So it's okay to admit to having faults, you know. In fact, it's a very grown-up and mature thing to be able to do that. Because then we can actually go beyond that and we can actually purify ourselves further. This ability to acknowledge our own faults is so important. And even if somebody else comes to you and tells you, you have done so and so bad, don't straight away become too defensive. Instead, think about it. Do they have a point? And if they have a point, use that as a way of growing in the Dhamma. If they haven't got a point, you can just dismiss it, of course. So this is really the things that are conducive to meditation practice. Meditation isn't good enough yet. You now know where you have to look. In your conduct, body, speech, and mind. Okay, so again, all of these things are done in private and in public, right? There's full integrity in all of these things. And then we come to the last factor here. And the last factor is the noble view that leads to liberation, to the utter destruction of suffering. And he has a slightly strange translation here, but and you have that with both your fellows, both in public and in private. And this, again, is what we were talking about before. The noble view is the view of the Aryas. You have understood the Dhamma. You have seen the arising and passing away of phenomena. You understand about suffering and non-self and all of that thing. So essentially, this refers to stream entry. And this is kind of the highest friendship, right? When all your friends are stream enters and you kind of have a common understanding together. That, of course, is very, very beautiful and very high. Because you tend to blend together very easily, because you have this commonality. You know the truth about things. You know what you have to do. You know what you have to practice, and then there is no issues there. So, as long as monks hold to these six qualities and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. And so there you are. Lots of things today, so many things, and each one of these topics we could have talked about them much longer, but they are really, because as I said, these are really not, I think, the main thrust of the sutta. I have gone over them fairly quickly, but probably deep enough for you to get a fairly good idea of what these things are about. So I'm going to stop there, because I may have gone too long already, so there's no point in going any longer than that. So, have you got any last questions anyone would like to ask? John Treasure, yeah?
The loving kindness, it just states there to the fellows, you know, in the community.
Yeah.
But why doesn't it go further and say that the loving kindness should be everywhere, you know, to all beings everywhere?
So that means I don't have to have loving kindness towards you, John, is that what it means? No, of course not. It doesn't mean that at all. But I think what it means, as I said before, that those people that it's challenging to have loving kindness for are often the people who are closest to you, right? That's where the real challenges are. Huh? I must admit, in the monastery like Bodhidharma, it's not that difficult to have a sense of kindness towards everybody, because everybody's really practicing well and doing the right thing. But it's still more challenging because you see them every day, right? And when you see people every day, week in, week out, sometimes year in, year out, of course, it can be challenging. But when I come here to Dhammaloka, it's incredibly easy to have a sense of kindness towards everyone here, right? I see you once a month or something. It's actually very, very easy. Don't really have to worry about that, right? So that is kind of the easy part. So I think that happens automatically, especially if we have that kind of good community in Bodhidharma Monastery. It kind of carries on when you come into Dhammaloka. There is no issue there anymore. So I think that is the main reason. It doesn't mean that towards others you can just kind of do whatever you like. It certainly doesn't mean that. Okay. Anything else anyone like to say, comment on? Complain about? No, I shouldn't ask for complaints. It's always dangerous. So everybody okay? Yeah? Okay. So let's have a look at a couple of questions from outside. So this is from a person called Brooklyn, I guess. If I reincarnated as a human, how can I continue to practice Buddhism with me so that I can continue, for I'm almost 60 years and I have serious karmic baggage. Okay, so that is an interesting question. And as always, that question too is actually answered in the suttas. This is why the suttas are so cool, because almost any question you can imagine is actually answered there if you know how to look in the right way. First of all, I wouldn't recommend you to think too much about serious karmic baggage. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. Maybe you mean that you have done something in your life that you're not so happy about, right, in your early life. That may very well be the case. But remember that very important simile of the grain of salt that you find in the suttas. If you want to look it up for yourself, please do so. Just go to Sutta Central, go to the Anguttara Nikaya 3's Sutta number 100, and you find the simile of the grain of salt. And what that says is that as you continue doing good, doing the right thing in this world, you dilute all the bad things that you have done before, right? You dilute it, until the effect of those things start to really, really fade away. So what you have to do, and this is not just about meditation practice. Meditation practice is only a small part of this. This is about your overall conduct, right? How you treat people around you, your sense of generosity, how you think about other people. These are the things really that really matter. And if you do those, you can actually build up good karma fairly quickly, because you're really give everything in your life to living a kind and a good life. There's no other purpose to life, really, apart from doing that. Everything else is secondary. Everything else is kind of, it's not a waste of time, but it's kind of there to support you doing the good things in the world, right? So put everything into that. And as you do that, you are diluting the negative results of any negative things that you have done in your life before. So if you feel regret and remorse for what you have done, this is the way to overcome that. And gradually the regret and remorse will fade into the background and you will feel like a new person. It's like a kind of rebirth, right? But in a rebirth in this very life, in a metaphorical sense. That is the right way of doing that. That simile of the grain of salt, I didn't actually say it out, basically is that if you take a grain of salt, you put it in a glass of water, the glass of water is undrinkable. Take the same amount of salt, put it in a large pond or in a river or something, you will barely be able to taste the salt at all. Perhaps you won't taste anything here. And the idea here is that the salt is a metaphor here for the bad actions you have done. The water is a metaphor for the good actions you have done. So when you have a lot of bad actions compared to the good actions, grain of salt in a glass of water, then the water is undrinkable. But if you have the same bad actions in a large amount of good actions, basically there is no remnant, there is no residue, there is no remnant of the taste. And so there is no problem there anymore. So that is what you have to do, right? Never think about the serious karmic baggage. Think about how to deal with it in the here and now to the best of your ability. That is the first part of that question. The second part is, how do you continue in a future life? Because that also is actually spoken about in the suttas. And what the Buddha has to say about that is that if, for example, in your next life you get reborn in some kind of heavenly realm or among wherever it is, whether it's among humanity or whatever it is, what you have to have is you have to have enough understanding of the Dhamma so that you recognize it in your future life. This is the main issue, right? And to be able to recognize it is important that the Dhamma you understand is the same Dhamma that those people will speak, right? And of course, that Dhamma, the only Dhamma which goes across time, across all cultures, across everything, is the word of the Buddha itself. The word of monastics, the word of people who have existed historically in Buddhism, all those teachings, apart from the teaching of the Buddha, they are transient, they tend to disappear, they are idiosyncratic, they depend on the person who is teaching them. But the only thing that persists through time, for at least until a certain point, eventually that disappears too, but at least for quite a while, is the teaching of the Buddha himself. And that is one of the reasons why it is so useful to read the suttas and to understand these core teachings, because that will then carry on into the future, even from life to life, and then you will be able to continue where you are at now. But of course, the practice is just as important, because the more pure your heart is, the more purified your mind is, the greater will be your ability to appreciate those teachings, and the better platform you have to continue practicing those teachings in the future. So all of those things together, right? And then, then you're heading in the right direction. Okay, so I hope that helps. So good luck with that. Don't wait to next life, but get on with it now, and then you create the foundation. Next one is Lean from the US. How can one meditate away from frustrated feeling of being obstructed from achieving one's goals when they are wholesome intentions? E.g., using one's talents to better the world. Okay, so the right approach to doing good in the world is not to look at the results of your actions. If you are attached to the results of your actions and you think that the results must be like this, other people must become happy because I'm doing the good thing, then it's not going to work, right? Because you don't know the results of your actions. You may have the best intentions in the world. Sometimes it doesn't work out. So what you have to do is you have to do what is right, do what is good, and not worry too much about how it affects the world around you. A lot of the time, it is going to affect the world around you in a really good way, because usually when you are kind, other people respond in a very good way. This is tends to be the nature of things, but not always. And because of that, it is none of your business whether other people respond well or not. That is their business and their problem. If they are so stupid that they don't react well to your kindness, it is their problem. They are the ones being stupid. You are being wise because you're doing the right thing. So this is the right attitude to these things, just to remember that you do your best. And if the results are great, great. And if the results aren't so great, well, at least they are great for you, because you are making good karma. You are doing the right thing here. Yeah? So, and don't worry too much about the world. Worry more about your own spiritual condition, that you are moving in the right direction in your own spiritual life. Because the world, you can only do so much for the world. The world, there's so many causes and conditions working on the world from all kinds of directions, right? That is very hard to know how much effect you will actually be able to have anyway. So you do what is right. You do your little bit, but you come back to your spiritual practice as your mainstay. That is the most important thing. And you use your actions in the world to support that spiritual practice. And if it doesn't have an effect, that's also fine. That is the best way of dealing with that. So that will also have an effect on how you practice your spiritual life. You will become a little bit more detached, a little bit more cool about it, and that you will feel much better about it as a consequence. Okay, great. So that is all for today. So let's, any last questions? Nobody happy? Okay, let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.